Hello and welcome to Millennial 2017, number 57. This is the last one before Christmas, although in some time zones it is already Christmas. For those people, I will say Merry Christmas. And this one is with Steve Franson, who is an identitarian YouTuber. You might have seen him on This Week on the Alt-Right on Tara McCarthy's channel. So hello, Steve. Welcome to the channel.
Hi, Wos. Thanks for having me.
Could you describe yourself and the kind of videos you make and that sort of thing so that people are familiar, so that people are introduced to you?
Sure, yeah. Well, I think a lot of my videos really focus on self-knowledge. They focus on psychology. They focus on relationships, standards in relationships, empathy. And then I sort of take these cool tricks and sometimes I apply them to the world. And so sometimes I comment on current events and that can be a lot of fun. I tried to go to bat in a major way for Donald Trump to get him into the presidency. And I've been around for a few years, mostly in philosophy circles and anarcho-capitalist circles. And now you can catch me in identitarian circles. So I feel like I'm learning, I'm growing. I'm an autodidact. I'm just, I'm keen on engaging in the world and seeing what comes from it. So,
sorry, where did you say you were before ANCAP?
I was ANCAP. I was paleo conservative for a long while. And then I became ANCAP thanks to Mr. Stefan Molyneux. And then when that looked really futile and autistic and Donald Trump came on the scene, I said, okay, it's time to get on the Trump train. So I've been roughly a nationalist or, you know, I like ethno-nationalism. I like identitarianism, these sorts of things. So.
And you describe yourself as a white advocate.
Yeah, I definitely say so. Like, yeah, white advocate through and through. So,
okay, all right. So let's talk about your journey toward to end up in this position. I mean, presumably it's not the end of your evolution, but it's where you are just now. So, where did you start out from? How were you raised in terms of politics and so on?
Yeah, I was raised paleoconservative. I was raised in Central Oregon. A lot of the men in Central Oregon are, I don't know if you're familiar with the state of Jefferson, but there's a sort of separatist movement down there.
Yes, I heard about it at the time when I was there, and we actually saw, I think it was a car with that sticker on it.
Yeah.
I think that was it.
Yeah, yeah.
Might have been a billboard. I can't remember. It was something quite conspicuous.
Right, right. Well, there's some real staunch anti-communists down there. And so I got a real taste of that growing up. I was a real sort of belly-aching sort of rancher, you know, out in the middle of nowhere sort of feel to things. And I would really pick up on this in the barber shop. My dad would take me to the barber once a month or once every 6 weeks. And he'd just shoot the breeze with guys like Beaver was one of them, or Bear was another. There's a guy named Bear. You know, some Johns and some Bobs and stuff like this, but basically a lot of old colonial stock that really had it out for the federal government. And so that had a massive influence on me. We moved more toward Portland, Oregon, more towards the suburbs as I was older. That was a confusing time for me. Liberalism is really, it's like Portland. I don't know if you know Portlandia and the Portland hipsters. It's just like, it's a mess. I mean, they're so socialist there.
I was in Portland briefly for about 4 days, actually during the election last year. I was there when that happened. And yes, I got my first taste of being amongst real life like hipsters in their natural habitat. And yeah, it's pretty strange.
Yeah, they're a bunch of goofballs. I mean, you know, but they're kind of my people in some ways. They're from the mountains and from the forests, and so it's this confusing sort of mix that's going on there. And that was really confusing for me till Ron Paul came on the scene and he started talking about the Federal Reserve. And then I remembered it all sort of came rushing back and oh, this feels right. Okay, this is good. And so I did like students for Ron Paul at my college. I, you know, went to bat for him, tried to do what I could. You know, it was this sort of beautiful failing sort of thing. He didn't get very far. And but it was, there was a kind of beauty in it because so many people got awoken and helped out and, you know, sort of sorted out on things. And
yeah, you're absolutely right. There was a sort of tragedy about Ron Paul. You knew it was never going to, he was never going to become the president.
Right. Yeah. And I loved that theme. It was one of the themes that sort of appealed to me the most, is this outsider without a punching chance, trying to get his way in there. And so, you know, that turned me on. There was this guy that was sort of poo-pooing Ron Paul at the time. His name was Stefan Molyneux. And who is this guy? Oh, my God. You know, oh, he's so arrogant. I can't stop listening to him. You know, like, listen to him for like 3 years straight, 4 hours a day. And eventually my brain changed completely. And, you know, I picked up a lot of skills, picked up philosophy, picked up argumentation, logic, personal relationships, standards. All this juicy stuff that's in his back catalog that I don't think a lot of people are really hip to. They, you know, a lot of people that have caught on in the last couple of years, they know him for the Trump stuff and for the true news and for sort of rebutting the fake news or whatever. But there's actually a whole treasure trove there. And so I became very steeped in that and very involved in Free Domain Radio. And that sort of blew my mind to another level. And I decided in about 2013, I was going to start making videos and talking on YouTube and talking about my point of view. And I guess, you know, one of my big sort of hills to die on is better treatment for children. And that's something that I've been a real staunch advocate for. And that's something that I picked up from him, from Alice Miller, from a lot of these sort of these Carl Jungs, these, you know, Abraham Maslow, Carl Rogers, all these sort of psychological, quasi-psychological thinkers, they led me down this journey of looking at, wow, how do we treat our children? And what does this say about our society? And what are the differences between the third world and the first world? And a lot of that has to do with genetics, obviously. But some of it has to do with how we treat children. And so I've been speaking about that a lot, and that's a near and dear sort of cause for me. And from there, I started thinking about, well, I'd like to be the best father I can humanly be. I want to be the very best father that's ever lived. And so I've sort of gone in some interesting directions as a result of that desire. And I think that's put me to where I am today. And of course, I have a child on the way. I'm going to be a father in the spring. So There you go. That's it in a nutshell.
Oh, congratulations. Okay, so one of the themes that we were going to talk about was self-knowledge. Something I've said on my channel countless times is that people should try to examine themselves, not for the sake of a sort of morbid wank fest, but really so that they know their own vulnerabilities and their own tendencies, their own habits, so that they can, well, avoid them if necessary. And I think it's part of, if you're going to try to be logical and rational and objective about the world, then you first, I think, have to know thyself. I'm guessing you would very much agree with that.
Oh, yeah, that's the first commandment of philosophy. Know thyself. So I also like the to thine own self be true. And, you know, this can lead you down some interesting paths of self-exploration to figure out what's true and what's not true about me. I think we get a lot of conflicting messages growing up, a lot of propaganda, a lot of lies, and a lot of things meant to keep us small. And so to begin to subvert that and to begin to break out of that is a really fun process. It's a process that I do professionally. So I work as a consultant, and people reach out to me and I consult with them. You know, we'll have calls on Skype and I'll sort of help them to be more empirical about their lives and empirical about who they are. And that's a very rich process. It's a lot in it. You know, it has to do with counseling, psychology. I lean heavy towards philosophy. I think a lot of that soft science stuff is a little, you know, it can be very open to Marxist interpretation and Marxist sort of subterfuge. I've written about that in my book, Make Self-Knowledge Great Again, that a lot of psychology has been used to turn people into pawns and automatons and weak bugmen.
And so, right.
So I take a very sort of Faustian approach. I really want to help people unlock their courage, their moral courage, because that's what we need in these times. We need to really punch through the veil with some moral courage.
And how does philosophy help with counseling?
Well, philosophy is, you know, it's about being empirical. What is reality? Knowing reality and using principles to know reality. So philosophy is important because I think a lot of people don't have a compass in their lives. They don't have any sort of system by which to decide things for themselves and who to choose in this life and what jobs to do and what's going to benefit them. And psychology offers some solutions. Psychology says, well, you want to be happy. Well, how do you be happy? Well, there's these things called psychiatric drugs. Or, oh, there's this yoga. You can do yoga and just sort of make your problems go away. And there's no real sort of transformative power to these sort of things. But philosophy really digs into narratives. It digs into what's happened. And we start to look at this with our history. And we start to understand the stories and the narratives that have sort of come up for us as people and how this has shaped us. And whether this is really to our favor or not. And most of the time, it's not. And so to learn to rewrite that, learn to take control of that and be really empirical about it. Like, yeah, no, I'm not going to fall for these tricks. I'm not going to fall for the globalism. I'm not going to fall for these softy leftist psychologist sort of, obfuscations. I'm going to really choose a clear path is really empowering.
See, when you say lefty sort of Marxist psychology stuff, I immediately think of power dynamics and how they're obsessed with you can't exaggerate how obsessed they are with power and that oppressor and oppressed. And it sounds like you're actually, oddly enough, talking in a similar sort of vein about things that are done to us or circumstances that are constructed around us that end up oppressing us.
Right.
Ironically enough. I mean, what would you say about that?
Well, I think that's a pretty interesting observation. I think one of the main sort of pitfalls of this sort of leftist gooey softness is radical egalitarianism. And it's actually this idea that we're all equals. And so any sort of differences between us have to be chalked up to prejudice.
And power. I mean, it's the power dynamic is making us unequal.
Right. And so... So I think about the stranglehold that the Marxists have had on the public schooling system, on our government, and in a way they've exercised a very real power over people that would otherwise sort of been raised more empirically. They would have been homeschooled. They would have been raised in training guilds and apprenticeship programs and situations where they'd be plugged much more into market dynamics. And so... I think we have to break that stranglehold. We have to...
Oh, yeah. And also just the fact of learning a skill, like an apprenticeship, a guild. I think that is such a good idea. It just seems like a healthy society. You know, you'd have implicit hierarchy, but it wouldn't be cold. It would be based on clear evidence that that guy is more skilled, he is more experienced, and so on. And I think it would also the skill would filter down. You know, because you have the levels of apprenticeships and novices and masters. So, and also, crucially, it would allow every guy to have a place in that hierarchy. Probably not at the top level, obviously, but he could graduate towards that. But either way, he would have the security of knowing where he is and that it would be based on empirical data regarding his skill level and so on. And that would give him a sense of, well, yeah, security, which I think is really missing. Because so much of education now is sort of phantom-like. You know, I heard about a guy who needed to get a certificate. He'd been doing, this is sort of a random story, but this is what happened. He'd been doing He was like a handyman. I don't know if you have that word in America. Just odd jobs. He'd been doing them for 40 years. And then the government brought in legislation so that in order to continue doing some of his jobs, he needed to get a certificate. So he went to a college to get these certificates. And there he was trained by guys in their 20s. And he'd been doing this for 40 years. And I thought, wow, he's probably not a master of any particular trade, but he is clearly very skilled and flexible, and he'll know how to get the job done using this skill or that skill. And he's being talked down to by someone who is probably nowhere near as skilled as him. Maybe not even skilled in any one particular thing, let alone have his versatility. And, you know, what I'm saying is, I think a lot of education now is just based on certifications. And it doesn't actually matter how skilled you are. You know, it's you have this position of authority over someone else simply because you have the certificate, not because you have the skill or the knowledge or the talent. And that is perverse, honestly.
Right. Yeah, I totally agree. I had trained a bit to be a counselor, to be a licensed professional counselor or a mental health counselor, or however you want to call it, a psychologist. And my supervisors were nutty. They were so dumb, and they were such like droids in the system. Just like, oh, I went to the mall this weekend, and you wouldn't believe what I saw at the mall. And I'm sitting there, and I'm like, oh, you know, I'm just like burning up, and you know, ready to do everything, and so ambitious. But I had to sort of I had to check it. And I was told, don't rock the boat. And I was interrogated at a few points. You know, I was treated with suspicion, like there's something unusual about you. And we need to stamp this out. You might need to see help for this thing that you have. And really, it's a burning passion for life. But they wanted to stamp it out. And so they held me under scrutiny, and they would interrogate me to determine whether I could proceed in the program or not. And at this point, my clients were knocking down my door. They were saying, come to your private practice, like, we need you. And, you know, things took off for me full time. So I left any sort of counseling training behind. I just didn't need it. I was beyond. I was sort of like in a hierarchy of awareness. I was much higher than these PhDs telling me this basic bitch stuff.
Yeah. I mean, it's, well, congratulations, first of all. But I think that, and that is a great story, and I'm very pleased for you. I think it's, there is a certain thing that, I hate this cliche because I suspect it's as much true as untrue. But there is the cliche that those who can do it, those who can't teach about it. And I think at any rate, whether that's true or not, I think in colleges especially and universities, you get these people who did know about something once, but they've now been teaching about it for 30 or 40 years and they're bored.
Right.
You know, it's the passion is gone.
Right.
And I think that's really sad. Certainly in Britain, I think that a lot of, there's just a general mood of mediocrity about college education, I suppose, and university education, to be honest, as well, unless it's one of the really famous universities, but especially colleges, but trade schools, that sort of thing. There is a sense of boredom. And I think it's part of the culture, actually. But I don't know for sure. But it sounds like that's kind of what was going on there with your experience.
Yeah, it's, you know, getting caught up in the system of credentialism and wondering how the hell do I get out of here, but still establish some sort of authority with people. And that's very difficult. I think it's very difficult. There's not much infrastructure in place for that yet. We have a system of incentives based on, you know, follow the carrot through the academia circus rings. So, you know, I've always learned from the example of Stefan Molyneux. I'll probably say his name a few more times during this interview. You know, he has this attitude of like, go down in the marketplace and speak with people and find out what the hum and the pulse is of what's happening in the society. And then speak to those needs and speak to what's going on with that. And you'll find your place. And that sort of gets into courage, that gets into moral courage, because there are moral sort of conundrums in our society. And you become an actor when you engage in these conversations. It's something I've appreciated about you, is you're doing this millennial thing and you're talking to tons of people, and you just got off a chat with a real oddball, you know? And it's like, but hey, you're in the market. And I think that people start to, especially young people, will see this and they'll go, oh, this is different than that whole, well, I've got a PhD sort of thing.
Well, YouTube has allowed this to happen. You know, it's not just me. I think that this general opening up of communications channels has been a really good thing, because it does sidestep the established framework, the established hierarchy, which I think is largely, as I say, stale. Certainly, if you want new ideas, you should come to YouTube. You shouldn't be watching TV because it's just drivel at this stage. But also, I think if you want new ideas, you shouldn't be going to university either. Because, as you've said, well, I'll put it in my own terms, the social sciences are now dominated by Marxy, Waxy dinosaurs. Yeah. And it's very stale. I mean, again, it's this obsession with power. It's so anemic. As an understanding of human beings and human societies, I find it amazingly boring. The idea of spending your career talking about that over and over again, you know, no wonder they're bored.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know what to say. I mean, I once did a thing about a video. A friend of mine had recommended Bell Hooks to me, and he was a leftist. And I had a look at her Wikipedia page, and it's just this. I mean, all the buzzwords, you know, about discrimination, oppression, and power, prejudice, dynamics, interpersonal, and all the rest of it. And yeah, it's the same old, same old. And I thought, fuck. You know, there are people who somehow get excited by this when I find it amazingly dry at this stage.
Right. Well, these are like people that are nostalgic for the 60s. How much more behind the times can you be? Where in your own mind, you're like, oh, the 60s were great. These people are dinosaurs and they're just getting blown out of the water. It's really fun. It's really fun to see all the young minds that are coming up. You know, real whiz kids that are putting together some pretty impressive YouTube videos and tweets. Some people have a real strong Twitter game. You bump into these people and they're just like, they're crafting things. And this is very creative. And I don't know, it doesn't have much to do with power and prejudice and justice and all these sort of weird, you know, aberrations on human psychology that have nothing to do with just consistent empiricism, curiosity, adventure, learning the themes that made the West great. This sense of openness, the pioneer spirit, the desire to go to the stars, that's a very sort of open-ended quest. And so young people are really stepping it up these days. I feel really encouraged. I feel really excited to be a part of something greater than myself.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, previously, the only way you could hear talking heads just talking ideas like we're doing right now was on TV, and obviously that costs a fortune to produce and it's got to go through layers of you know, production commissioners or whatever they're called, editors and commissioning editors. Well, now that doesn't have to happen, and we can have a meaty debate here, and it will probably be, I mean, well, it could well be as meaty as any debate you would see on TV. And it's for free, and it hasn't been, you know, passed through layers of essentially censors. I think this is a fantastic thing that YouTube has afforded us all.
Yeah, we get to convey something substantive. We get to convey something subversive. We get to convey passion and conviction, and like I've said a few times now, moral courage to fight and to speak truth to power. And that has nothing to do with these old time dinosaur mediums, you know, oh, what race mixing am I going to tune into today? Or, you know, what sort of thing?
Yeah.
You know, yeah. It's a madhouse over there on television. So,
well, yeah. I mean, the prime example of this, of course, is that they would never have an alt-right voice or an identitarian voice who was intelligent. And I said this in one of the previous hangouts, because it's just, and that tells you immediately that they are not interested in ideas or in informing the public. They're interested in, well, shaping the public according to their own preconceived ideas. So, again,
Are we talking about Jordan Peterson here?
No, I wasn't even thinking.
I'll take you up on that debate. You know, I wanted you guys to debate, so.
Oh, I wasn't even thinking about Jordan Peterson there. I was thinking more about the BBC, that sort of thing. No, Jordan, honestly, I didn't even have him in mind. I don't know why I kind of regret doing that video about him, because is there any point punching right, as or whatever that would be, punching left, when he's doing something? You know, yeah. He is a gatekeeper and he is combating the SJWs, and that might seem sort of low-hanging fruit, to you and me, but it's not really. I mean, it's a battle that does need to be fought.
Yeah, these are results, and everyone can get results at whatever level they're fighting at, as long as they adhere to some sort of principle. And, you know, it's pretty easy to just point people in the direction, go, these are globalists, nail them. You know, and then there's results, and things get better. So, you know, it's an exciting time to be alive. I think 2018 is going to be a year of massive gains. I think we're going to really put these people on their heels and start to dominate. So,
I hope so. I hope so. It could really go either way, to be honest. And I've learned not to get too optimistic, because, you know, you can get disappointed very easily. Mm-hmm. I don't want to be a downer. I mean, maybe it will be a great year. I'm just, I want to take it as it comes. Yeah. But part of that, of course, is something else that we're going to talk about here, which is community strength. Because obviously, and we don't need to get too much into the Thoughtgate thing, but you did a video about it, and I did a video about it. We were both, I think, perturbed by that. And it wasn't just, you know, a desire to protect women. I think it was also, certainly in my case, it was also very much a case of, I just hated the disturbance. I hated that we were working against each other, these different parts of the movement. And I thought, why the fuck are we doing this? It's not gonna benefit us in any way. We're gonna be left fractured and demoralized and paranoid, not trusting each other anymore because we've fought against each other. So that was a big reason why I made the video about it. And also, yeah, I didn't like the ridiculous statements that were being made about women, but that's another matter. I think in terms of this conversation, I want to focus on the community aspect of it, because what happened there, whether that thing was engineered from outside or from within, it doesn't really matter. That it had the effect of sowing mistrust and sapping morale and pitting people against each other. Sorry, you go.
Well, I was going to say, Tara McCarthy was on your show, and I obviously am on This Week on the Alt-Right with her, and she's had a pretty good impact on my thinking. She was saying to you that a lot of these young guys don't think about the impact the things that they're going to say will have, and that you have to be strategic about these things, that these things matter. And I've been fairly impulsive up until about a year ago, when I started learning to be a little bit more strategic and put a little bit more forethought into the things that I was going to say publicly. And we're probably going to need to have some measure of tactical silence, some kind of tactical silence from time to time. And I don't know where or when that's going to be. That's something for me to learn. But I think in order to maintain cohesion, you know, a lot of this stuff has to fall by the wayside so that we can stay focused. And I made a fuss about it, but Tara actually stayed pretty quiet about this thing. So, and she sort of kept on doing her thing. And to me, that was impressive.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think the main thing is that the damage to the community in general. What do you mean by tactical silence?
Well, I think what I've started to notice and started to wonder about is that I wonder if you, in order to rise in influence, this is a little theoretical here. This is, just something I've been chewing on. I wonder if to rise, like I look at a lot of these alt-light sort of people, and I know a few of them are much more red-pilled than they let on. You know, I've got a 9 cents, and then I've also got some behind-the-scenes information. And so I look at it and I go, I think they're engaging in tactical silence. Why would that be? How can I do this? And it's something I'm toying around with, because a year ago, I was like, this is the truth about World War II. Let me tell you the truth about World War II. La, da, 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 da. And it's like nobody cared. Nobody really cared. But when I would do things, and when I've done things like, I sort of read into things and I'll highlight a certain something. Oh, Trump train this, Trump train that, or, this is a hypocrisy between the left and their standards and how they're applying them to others. Oh my gosh. when you point this out, I think that it's a lot more useful than sort of just trying to go right at the bone marrow truth of things every single time. I think people who try to do that every single time have some sort of ego staked on that. They have some sort of, well, this does something for me and this shows how truthful I can be. And it's really not about that. I think that you have to sort of let go of that and really think really in strategic and tactical terms and what it is that you're going to do and how it is that you're going to use your influence and how it is that you're going to craft your public persona and what role that's going to fill and who that's going to serve that's larger than you in the hierarchy. What do they need from you? How can you serve? This is something I've been thinking about more and more and just wondering about my own offerings and wondering about my, sometimes if I'm a little prone to purity spiraling or edgelording or even shitlording a little bit, it's like, you know, I could sort of rein some of that in. I do have a bit of an impulsivity to me. How can I sort of, you know, this gets into the self-knowledge thing and knowing your weaknesses a little bit. How can I be a little bit more, you know, composed here? So,
yeah, I think that you're absolutely right that ego does come into it. It's like, I want to be the edgiest shitlord delivering truth bombs like there's no tomorrow. And I want to be more brutal with it than anyone else and so on. I also think there's impatience. You know, I think a lot of guys think, and we're talking about guys here because it's in the context of the recent debacle, but, you know, whatever it is. I mean, the vast majority of the movement is guys. So I'll just use that term. There are guys who think everyone else should know the truth now. And we don't have time to fuck around. And well, I don't have time to fuck around. I don't respect them if they can't handle the truth. So, and so then that becomes telling the truth is a good filtering mechanism because if they can't handle it, then I know they're weak. And so they're not worth my time. But this is really self-defeating because people are more flexible in that. And somebody who can't handle the truth now, you know, in December 2017, might well be able to handle the truth, the full truth and nothing but the truth in June 2018. Yeah. But not if you have, in the meantime, alienated them so that they think you're a nutcase and you've turned them off the entire movement. Of course, then there's another get-out clause, which is, well, if they're that easily turned off, then we don't need them anyway. But again, I resisted certain truths for years. And here I am now red-pilling many, many people. So, you know, again, you should just be more flexible and understanding about the way that people actually are. They're not all desperados delighting in being outside the mainstream. Mm-hmm. You know, and there's no shame in that. There's no shame in being a normie. We use that word and it is kind of disparaging, I suppose. It sounds disparaging, but it's a useful word because it's a real category and it's a real category that we have to tolerate and interact with. We need the normies on side, basically.
Well, ostracism triggers the pain of abandonment. It's like being abandoned as a child. So social ostracism is a powerful, powerful force. And if you overwhelm people and you overload people with these red pills and this, oh, you're the cutting edge lord of truth. And, you know, this, you're really pitting your ego into this and really working this person. If they choose to go with this, they have to face ostracism, social ostracism from normie world, which is as painful as abandonment, as childhood abandonment. It's like a child losing their mother in a store or something. Like, it's very painful for them. And so they're going to resent you for pushing them toward that. This is about relationships, about connection. You don't just sort of like grab people, rip them out of the matrix and go, well, okay, good luck. Watch out for those bots flying around. You know, if you look at Matrix, Neo is pulled out of the matrix. He's nursed, he's helped, he's given this cereal porridge soup. He makes friends with Dozer and Tank and he's there and they've got a tight little community in their ship. That's how proper red pilling works. It's really about personal connections, about relationships. As much as you can possibly make it, I think that you'll have success. I think if you go around ripping things out of the garden and wondering why things aren't working, well, you're not going to gain much status and reputation and influence in this culture war. And you need to be able to do that if you have some sort of handle on the truth. After all, it's not all about you. It's about the truth. It's about winning. So,
I think that's a crucial thing to emphasize, that this is about winning and we are talking about winning. We're not talking about being cowardly or just being nice for the sake of it, although there's not much wrong with that, to be honest, we're talking about what is best for winning this war, this culture war. And I think you have to be patient with people. You have to be realistic about what people are like. There are people, guys, and who are very burnt out, and not necessarily guys who've been, fucked over by women or the divorce courts or lost their job to an ethnic minority. Not necessarily guys who are in their 30s or 40s or 50s, even teenagers today. The white male teenager of today does have a lot of reasons to be pissed off and burnt out. And I think that this is why I said in the video, I think that we should be finding ways to rehabilitate them, because, as they are, yeah, they're going to be very frustrated, and yeah, they're going to be very aggressive and lash out for various reasons. But that's natural. And it's young energy. Mm-hmm. And male energy, and we shouldn't be surprised by it. Unfortunately, there is not a hierarchy. There's not much of a hierarchy in society in general, but also within our community. So I think it's a matter of trying to set a good example, really. You have to lead by example, and I try to do that as far as I can. Mm. I do hope that we can rehabilitate them, basically. Mm-hmm. Say that their concerns with I should just say this for by way of a disclaimer, right? I'm not trying to discount their concerns about the women in the movement purely. I'm not trying to attribute it all to young male insecurity. I know full well that I understand the source of the concerns. I'm just saying that I think a lot of the energy behind those concerns was not as legitimate as they would like it to be.
Mm. Yeah. Well, the concept I think about is holding the hope. I hold the hope. And really what that means is that I have the confidence to help people see it through, see whatever sort of circumstances they're in through, if they have the motivation to hang in there and stick with it. And I think there are a lot of hardy young men coming up that do have the guts to attain the glory, but they just need some guidance and they need someone to hold some boundaries with them as they transition to, full use of their capacities. So I hold the hope. I have a lot of hope for these young men. I think that they're going to have bright futures. And if I were to regard them with the same cynicism that they want to lash out at others with, I would not be doing them a favor. I would not be offering them any sort of transformative narrative to hook into, to improve themselves.
Yeah, this is it. Yeah, we have to emphasize self-improvement. And I know that when I say those words, people will be saying, well, you're overweight and you smoke. Yes, I know. And I'm not happy about it. But the fact of my own flaws does not mean that other people should wallow in their flaws. This is a matter of being honest with yourself, because obviously when it's easy to criticize me, but that's as much as anything else, that's a way of getting out of doing something yourself. Self-improvement on your part. I think it is something that we should be pushing because God knows there's a lot of energy and talent going to waste. Mm. That's what I would say about that. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, one of the themes that this week on the alt-right turns to, someone who's really good about this is Mark Collett. Mark Collett's always challenging guys. You come out and do this assault course with me, 10K. Yeah, we'll find out if you're a real man. And, he's like really intense. And it's like, hell yeah. Like a lot of young guys get a lot of energy from that. And, this turning, we had Ayla, Wife with a Purpose, recently, on our last show. She was axed from Twitter, unfortunately. They didn't like her pumpkin pie recipes, it seems. So, but she was talking about homeschooling and the importance of that. And so there's this huge component of improving your own life. And it has to be stated and restated. I think a lot of people go into their intellect and they go into these abstractions and they stay sort of in their autism. Autism is a avoidance from emotional pain. It's an avoidance of reality. And so they go into their autism, they go on this internet space, and it's this great distraction away from very real problems in their lives. So that is a component that we emphasize on this week on the Alt-Right. We bring it in the personal, and we talk about, you know, how to self-improve and, you know, what options there are for people to turn things around in their own lives. Because really, fundamentally, that's the real struggle. That's the real struggle. The most pieced together people I've ever seen, legitimately pieced together, not faking it, not on psych drugs, but really sober, fit, healthy, in trusting, loving relationships. These people hear things like Bitcoin, and they hear things like anarcho-capitalism or the Trump train, and they naturally just sort of gravitate to them because they're in a condition of health. And these ideas are healthy. These movements, these strategies, these philosophies, whatever, they're healthier than the norm. They're healthier than what's been offered. And so it's sort of this, it's this nice synergy, and it's important to highlight it at times and not just stay in the abstractions, not just stay in the intellectual sort of sword fencings between faraway figures. Really bring it into the personal.
Yes, I agree. I think we wanted to speak about Christmas, since this is the last hangout before Christmas. So I think we could maybe bring that back into the community thing. What is your view of Christmas? What does Christmas mean to you? I know that you're not religious, neither am I, but obviously it is important. So could you talk about that?
Well, what I think about with Christmas is I immediately think of the birth of Christ, and I think of it as a kind of birth. It is a kind of renewal, and it is a time for rest and contemplation and connecting oneself and connecting with loved ones. And there's a sort of innocence, renewal that comes from that. You know, we think of baby Jesus, and we think of the sweet baby Jesus. We think of our Lord and Savior, baby Jesus. And he's in the manger, and it's such a beautiful scene. And the kings are there, and Mary is there, Joseph's there. And it's this beautiful, beautiful scene in the manger. And it's so innocent. There's a real innocence there that we've lost touch with. We've lost touch with our innocence. What all is this good for if we can't have a society where children can be innocent, where children can pursue their imagination and pursue the adventures that are unfolded before them? So that's what I think about with Christmas. It's like, oh, it's the kind of a birth of innocence. It's kind of a time to reconnect and a time to go into a bit of a hibernation mode and then emerge. So I hope that a lot of people do that. I hope people see it that way so that they can come into the new year feeling refreshed and reconnected with what it is that drives them, the real spark in life, what gives them their purpose. I say it's innocence. We all have innocence somewhere in us. Those of us who haven't been corrupted, those of us who really fight in for Western civilization, we have innocence in us somewhere. And if we can self-reflect and we can connect with that, we'll be all the better in the coming year, and we'll prosper, we'll flourish.
Okay. I think that's very true. I do see this as a time of hibernation, ideally, but also healing. I think that's the most important thing here, because it has been an exhausting year. Oh, yeah. And I think we took a lot of knocks. And I hope that Millennial has had that effect on people of healing some of the rifts in our community and making people feel better about things. So it's not over yet. There are another, I think, two nights of it. I think it's the 27th and 28th. So I hope you tune in for those. I think that's all, really. I think we should just end on a positive note. Can you come up with some words of encouragement for the community?
Yeah, of course. Well, you know, we're really short on love in this world. And if you can connect with the people you love, and you can connect with what you love about life and what you love about yourself, spend some time with that and sort of breathe, calm down, and lick your wounds. I think that next year will go a lot better. It will be an improvement over this year, and, you know, we'll keep improving. So find where it is that you feel that love, where you feel that tenderness, where you feel a bit of vulnerability with life, it can be so easy to be battle hardened. Ooh, look at me, I'm battle hardened. But to soften and to be vulnerable, that's the spice of life.
And it does take guts in and of itself.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Well, let's leave it at that. This was Steve Franson, and that's it for tonight. And I'll be back in 3 days. There are some stuff, some videos going up tomorrow, but not any more Hangouts until I think the 27th. So that's it then. Thank you, Steve Franson.
Merry Christmas.
Okay, and thanks to everyone at home for watching, and yeah, absolutely, Merry Christmas to you all. I'll see you in a few days.